Welcome to the Jonah Carey Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, friends. Today's guest is a good one. It is Alex Wolf. Alex is a longtime writer for Sports Illustrated. He's the author of a really cool book called The Audacity of Hoop, which came out last year, 2016, and is about former President Barack Obama and his love of basketball and kind of how that all that blends together. Beautiful book, too. Really, really cool photos. Grabbed some from Pete Souza, who's, of course, the great White House photographer who now has his own book out, and beautifully illustrated, thoughtful and interesting book, and shed some light. So if you're into politics or discussions of the 44th president or basketball or any of that stuff put together, then you will definitely dig this book. Really, really neat. Alex has written so many cool stories for Sports Illustrated over the years, primarily on basketball, but has written about college athletics in general and corruption. He's an interesting guy, influential writer for me, one of the SI crew there. I've talked about Michael Farber before, my appreciation for him, William Knack, Gary Smith, Steve Rushen. The list goes on and on. And we got into the kind of the glory years of SI and the changes in college basketball and lots of good stuff. And I recorded it with him a while ago on his farm property, I guess you could say, in Vermont. And it was a cool chat, and it was not time sensitive per se, so we kind of got to hold it for a while, but a good time to do so now with college basketball in full swing. So yeah, I hope you enjoy today's episode of the Jonah Carey Podcast with Alex Wolf. Talking about Free Darko and stuff, which we'll get into. Well, and maybe there's the way to jump into this is I like, we talked about the idea of timelines, and you mentioned that you were working on anthologies, basketball anthologies. So before we get into Free Darko and Simmons and Zaclow and everything else, why don't we start by talking about, I don't know what the origins of basketball writing are. I mean, there's Ring Lardner and Red Smith and stuff when it comes to baseball. Who are the giants of basketball writing? Were there any before like the 60s?
Not really. Yeah. Because the giants of sports writing had no time or use for basketball.
Right.
Red Smith famously hated it. He called it whistleball. At that time, basketball was, truth be told, college basketball was a collection of these little regional cults.
Yeah.
And pro basketball was kind of Bush League. Fort Wayne.
Yeah.
No slight on Fort Wayne. But,
right.
And so you needed somebody with prominence to take an interest in it and maybe set aside the horse racing and boxing and golf
right.
a little bit. So that didn't really happen until the 60s. I mean, you had Bill Bradley, interestingly enough, he helped to begin two major nonfiction careers. One was Frank DeForge.
Mm-hmm.
He shows up at SI from Princeton and as Frank himself put it, I had Bill Bradley in my hip pocket. And
did they go, were they at this exact same time? Were they contemporary?
They overlapped. Frank was a senior when Bradley was a freshman.
Okay.
And then, of course, the most famous is John McPhee does this New Yorker profile of Bradley that
mm-hmm.
leads to a book which becomes the first of 30 books he'll do for Farrar Straus. And more importantly, he becomes a New Yorker staff writer shortly after that and never leaves. So you have those two people kind of taking basketball with them forward. And then I think basketball was kind of because of race and all sorts of other things.
Of course.
It was a perfect sport for the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
But it's pretty slim pickings. You know, you have Red Smith wrote this one column that we found for the anthology where he covered an NIT game involving Rhode Island.
How long ago?
This would have been in 47.
Gee.
And Rhode Island has this great fast break team that's all sorts of.
Led by Lamar Odom. No, that was later.
The forerunner of Lamar Odom was a guy
named Catino Mobley.
And of Catino was a guy named Ernie Calvert.
Okay.
Calvert Lee. And they, you know, they scored 80 points a game, and their coach was the same chemistry professor at the university who invented in the lab this light blue color that they wear to this day.
Cool.
And Rhett Smith kind of fell hard for the fast break and March Madness, basically.
Oh. So,
kind of in spite of his predisposition against the sport, you can read this piece and see that even Rhett Smith was beginning to fall for basketball come tournament time.
Well, and I mean, if you think about it, then that implies, well, unfortunately, Frank's just left us, but that implies that the legends of the sport are still with him. I mean, Bob Ryan would qualify as maybe one of the godfathers, and I can remember. Gee, I remember Bob Ryan reviewed a book that I worked on with Nate Silver and all the baseball perspectives guys called Baseball Between the Numbers. And in his review, he said, oh, I like this. Numbers, it's good. You know, and he's at heart, loves baseball. He's been a Fenway season ticket holder and all that. And he said, I wonder what it would be like to go with one of these fellows to a baseball game, though. Would they just quote equations at me all the time? It didn't work, but we exchanged emails. I said, yeah, let's go. I'll go together. I was living in New Hampshire at the time and I wanted to. But that's interesting to me that the thought of Ring Lardner or Red Smith walking among us is, to me, bonkers. Like, that's prehistoric almost. But if Bob's around, and it really would be, those guys would be the ones from the big sports sections. And then, I guess, whoever would write cover basketball for SI in the 60s, which I'm trying to think who that would be at that point.
Well, on the college side, I would argue that Curry Kirkpatrick.
Oh, right, yeah.
This was a big tastemaker.
Yeah.
You know, he had, even to the way he dressed when he showed up on Press Row, he was Tom Wolfe.
Yeah.
His style, and then DeFord, I guess by the early 70s, he left the beat and was doing the long takeouts. But
yeah,
there were plenty of others who stepped up for SI on the NBA beat, and John Papanek, and you know, more recently, I think Lee Jenkins, what he does for SI is.
The finals ends, and 10 seconds later, he's got the one thing that you would have never known about in a million years.
And
he's just a great reporter. I'm talking a great writer. He's just a reporter.
And yeah. He really reports the hell out of everything he writes and just has this way of distilling it. And he's figured out what, you know, obviously the marketers in Olympic Tower in Manhattan figured out a long time ago, but that basically there's 6 or 7 personalities that are the game today at any one time. And if you can wire that person and an orbital or two around that person, then you're so far ahead of the game. And I mean, just within 24 hours after the Warriors won, there was Lee talking about this text that Draymond sent Durant and all of the steps that took place.
How long do you think he sat on that? Because he must, it's not like he found it out that day. So that means he had to keep it a secret, maybe tell your partner or your dog, and that's, you have to sit. I'm just such a, maybe I tweeted, maybe I did this, maybe I did that. I just wouldn't be able to sit on it.
Well, maybe it's because Lee is still a weekly magazine journalist.
You know? Yeah.
There isn't that pressure on him.
Yeah.
As much as SI.com would love to have, you know, whatever's in his notebook.
Right.
But we've all had to kind of do the civil act, and since we started the web in earnest,
yeah.
Okay, what do you say for something that has to take a kind of longer view, and what do you want to disgorge on the web right away? And I think Lee's somebody who has that license in the same way that a guy like Verducci on baseball has that license.
Yeah, although, yeah, Verducci's notably not on social media because he's smart, which is, I would very much like to leave too, anyway. But yeah, that's right, and Verducci has a way, and he'll, you know, can incorporate stories onto TV as well, which is interesting.
Yeah. So many different platforms. But actually, just talking to you, John, I'm starting to clarify for me how recent the history of basketball writing really is. You know, Herbert Warren Wind, great golf writer for the New Yorker, he had about a 6 or 7 year run with SI back in the 50s where he did some great writing about Bob Cousy.
Oh.
And it turns out that Wind actually played basketball at Yale. I mean, Herbert Warren Wind was a college, a G1 college basketball
player.
So he did appreciate the game.
Yeah.
Somehow got a little light in. Actually, did pieces for both SI and the New Yorker on Cousy and the Celtics.
Right.
So, but even though he has a background in the game, he writes about it kind of anthropologically.
Right.
Back in the 50s, it's like this odd thing that he feels he has to take the reader by the hand and explain to.
Well, it wasn't mainstream.
Certainly not the NBA, at least.
It wasn't. Yeah. And he comments, actually, in this writing he does, about how disarming it is to have all this time with these guys. And in fact, when DeFord started on the beat, he had a Timex expense account, and all these NBA players wanted to go out to dinner with him. They weren't being paid anything.
Right.
So he'd be on these airplane flights, and he's in first class.
So Russell's like, yes, take me.
And Havlicek's in coach, you know, so.
Oh, gee.
It was a whole different era then. And obviously now, Lee Jenkins goes through three or four layers to get to the person who would stay up.
I'm already friendly with Mav. I'm working on it. I'm going to get LeBron on the podcast. Mav, I know you're listening, or one of your people is, for sure. This is happening. I'm doing it. I guess it'd be a two-parter then. Number one, did you always know you wanted to be a sports writer? Number two, did you imagine that basketball was going to be your thing?
I don't know that I always wanted to be a sports writer. Basketball is a pretty big part of my life from the 60s. I'm born in 57. And
you played as far as long as you could, basically?
I did. I still play noontime when I can.
I'll come back tomorrow.
Yeah, please do.
I'm 6'4".
You're on my team, man.
I'm the world's tallest Jew. Danny Shade, sorry.
Danny Shade?
Yeah. And Bob Shade.
Yeah. I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey in the 60s, so basketball was kind of part of what you breathe then with Bradley. And my pediatrician apparently told my mother that it was the one sport that he could recommend that young athletes play.
Well, football. I don't know why baseball's scary, but okay.
This is what he said, and I, being the eldest boy, I kind of listened to what my parents had to say. So here are my parents channeling the pediatrician, and it's something you could play by yourself in the driveway.
Yeah.
You could just shoot. And so basketball came first, and then I played through high school. And
if you grew up in Jersey, did you head to the city? Did you go to 4th Street? Did you go to Rucker? Did you do any of that stuff?
We moved from Central Jersey when I was 12 to suburban Rochester, New York.
Yeah.
And it was there that I would play in high school. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit going, you know, to Cobbs Hill Park, where the city and the suburbs kind of met, a little bit of that. But, you know, I poked around the student journalism in high school. It was really only my sophomore year in college. So I go back to Princeton for college. My sophomore year, I take a course, nonfiction writing course, and I get involved with this outfit called the University Press Club, which basically supplies stringers to New York papers, Philly papers, and everybody in between.
Yeah.
So I'm doing a lot of journalism, student journalism, and still kind of soaking up the game. And and then just before my senior year, a buddy of mine and I come up with this idea of doing a book about playground ball around the country. And we throw sneakers and a ball in the back of a rental car, and we kind of go find games, the two of us, and write it up.
Like in a Plimpton way, in an immersive way. That's
in an immersive
cool.
way,
yeah.
But the product was more kind of a Zagat survey of courts where to play.
That's cool.
And the in-your-face basketball book. So that became kind of my calling card when I'm looking for work after college. And so basketball and journalism was kind of in the cards early.
Well, and if you're in college, if I'm doing math, if you're born in 57, that means Breaks of the Game comes out right as you're coming of age. And I have to feel like if I was that age, I'd be like, oh, this is a thing? I could do this? Wow.
That's right.
I mean, that might be the best sports book of all time. It's way up there.
Yeah, it's the excerpted in the anthology. And it's...
Yeah.
So that season that Halberstam chose to follow the Blazers is Magic and Larry's rookie year.
Yeah.
They don't really figure in the book because it takes a few years for the retrospective. They clear how much they're going to change things, but that was a huge part. The other book that came out while I was in college that come to find a lot of other people like glommed onto was Rick Tellender's Heaven is a Playground.
He was big time, yeah.
So that would be the late 70s. So really the flowering of books about basketball. There's this famous George Plimpton comment, you've probably seen it. The quality of the writing is inversely proportional to the size of the ball.
Right.
Lots of great books about golf and very, very few about basketball. But whenever he said that, I've got to go find out exactly when he said it. But boy, there have been some good ones. Pat Conway.
Yeah. My losing season. My losing season. Yeah. My dad is a Conway guy. He said, go read all these five books. I said, okay. They're great. Yeah. Well, and then we are able to jump to... I want to jump back to you in a second, but let's keep going on this strain of how this is going. So that 70s, by the time we get to 80s, so now Bird and Magic have taken over, and then that's the proliferation of... I mean, the college ball is also growing at that point, but then I would imagine NBA writing just explodes at that point. So, well, actually, let's jump back to your thing for a second then. Are you specifically drawn to one more than the other at that point? Are you thinking, well, Magic and Bird, I'm seduced by this, I'm going to stay on the college front? Is it just basketball in general? Obviously, your work took you in a specific direction, but was there a thought, was there any fork in the road that said, oh, I need to go here as opposed to here?
It's really where the opportunities were.
Right.
What happened at SI in the 70s and the 80s, so the economy's going great guns, the magazine is too, still riding the coattails of TV and
yep.
people's interest. And what happens from roughly November through April is the magazine is doing, in addition to maybe a news lead in every issue about college basketball, there's a roundup, regional roundup from the four regions.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, a shorter feature. So there's a huge copy need for a very concentrated season.
Yeah.
So as a cub reporter, somebody who's hired essentially to be a fact checker,
yeah,
the chance to break in and actually do some writing is there with the colleges in a way there wasn't as much on the NBA.
That was sort of the next step on the ladder, and you couldn't jump into that right away?
Well, it wasn't that it was the next step on the ladder. It was plenty prestigious to yeah. do college basketball.
Yeah.
It was just that there were more opportunities. So okay. if they had a body they could throw, I had a chance to get some bylines and show what I could
give me
do.
$1,000 on Moncrief or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or go out to Briarcliff College in Iowa and tell us about this NAIA.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Panama. That was
cool.
My first story.
That's awesome.
And so John Papanek and Bruce Newman are on the NBA beat
mm-hmm.
and have that pretty well covered, but the colleges provide this opportunity. And then the thing about the colleges is you have these tentpole programs with coaches that tend to stay there, like Izzo,
yeah.
Krzyzewski and Dean Smith and Calhoun and so forth. So you can pretty quickly start to make the connections that will pay off over time,
right.
even as the players are cycling through. So I did more college than pro. I was on the pro beat for 1 year, the year that Kareem was MVP at age 40, whatever it was.
Wow.
But there would always be pro stories, and it seemed that the two would bleed into one another.
Well, that's when they grow up. That's what they go on to do.
Exactly.
And, of course, if you have these great contacts with Sidney Moncrief or whoever, then, okay, you went from Arkansas to the Bucks, and now we can talk, and that's that.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that Charles Barkley, I did a piece on him.
Oh, sure.
Sophomore at Auburn, and he pleaded with me that we do dominoes instead of, or Godfathers instead of dominoes, because it was a step up in pizza quality. And then a few years later, I'm talking to him as when he's a rookie with the Sixers,
yeah.
sort of asking, getting people to wonder why Bobby Jones is starting ahead of him. A question.
Yeah, Bobby Jones can play. Barkley is great, but Bobby Jones can play. I remember Bobby Jones.
Bobby Jones can play.
Yeah.
So and then the international thing starts, and that becomes also. I've never been one to kind of put boxes around
yeah.
these. I just see it kind of as a seamless garment of the game.
Right. That's interesting. So that those strains. So when I mean, we were talking just before we jumped on, and then when we jumped on, we started talking about the kind of the outsider strains with Bill Simmons and the Free Darko guys. Was there an outsider strain pre-proliferation of internet? In other words, did somebody come in and blow people away at any point who didn't come from a traditional columnist background, or maybe was a traditional J-school person, or maybe was a football writer, just took everybody by storm? I'm just trying to think if there were any kind of party crashers before, well, I guess before my generation of sports writers.
You know, there were people who came at it, usually in books, with a little bit of a different... There was a famous Leonard Coppett book, 24 Seconds to Shoot, which was kind of analytical.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of books. Nelson George did a book called Elevating the Game, which was kind of an African-American cultural approach.
Interesting.
Lewis Cole wrote A Loose Game. But these were all sort of somewhat sociological. So they weren't...
I like Terry Pluto's ABA book. That was good, too.
Yeah, and then the oral history. And then he did another one called Tall Tales, which was the early NBA guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, those books were great, and we're actually going to be including an excerpt from the book that Terry did with Bob Ryan.
That's awesome. I'm trying to get, when I do this podcast, I'm always trying to get people to read stuff. So everything that you're hearing, go get all these books. They're all great.
Yeah, or wait for the anthology.
When's that out?
It's going to be out the end of February.
Sweet.
Yeah. But we're really excited about the banquet table that we've laid out. But
yeah.
No, you raise a really good question. Okay, did it take the web to kind of democratize
this,
you know, and invite all these great new voices? And, you know, were those people out there back in the early 60s and the 50s?
They shouldn't have internet. But
I don't think so, because all these things that have happened with basketball, the internationalization, the empowerment of players so that they can, you know, plot to all go to Miami, whatever it is they're going to do, Draymond can send a text to Kevin Durant. That's kind of a piece with the idea that Free Darko could just be a message board for a bunch of Haverford College buddies.
That's where my wife went, by the way. That's to tie it all together.
And she probably knows half of those.
She knows Nathaniel. I think she was maybe a senior when he was a freshman, or at least knows of him. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. That's great. But that would then blow up, and that there are now, you know, 12 respectable outlets at least that have Free Darko, you know, deep state embeds in them today.
And the artwork was so revolutionary, too. I'd never seen anything like that before.
Yeah. I mean, they really had the whole multi-platform thing going, the two books and the posters they did. And there's a guy who was teaching at Michigan, Santiago Colas is his name. He taught a course called Cultures of Basketball. He since moved on to Oberlin, but he uses the macro phenomenon. No, the history of the game, the history of basketball as his core text for this course, and uses the Free Darko Manifesto as sort of a lens with which to, that it's about the players and it's not about loyalty to a particular team.
Right.
That you just need to open yourself up to these personalities and their styles, which that attitude is revolutionary. You know, to behold the association, as the Free Darko guys like to call it, as, you know, a bunch of wonderful musicians, as opposed to, you know, this tribal way of thinking. And that's pretty different. I
mean, yeah.
And I think that helps account for how the NBA is vaulted back, I think, into a better place.
It's not like San Antonio has 40 million people in that town or whatever, or Cleveland. It's that these people transcend the geography. And this is baseball's fundamental problem, by the way, is that it's the other way. Mike Trout is not LeBron. He should be. Mike Trout might be the best player since Willie Mays. We just don't get to hear about him that
much. And are we willing to sit through eight other guys hitting before we get to see Mike Trout sort of step in the center stage? And if the NBA is indeed, and I believe it is, going through a kind of renaissance now, I wonder if it isn't that whereas there was a time where if you were a great player, the most important thing to you would be that big contract, the most endorsements, it's all very self-centered.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've seen now with the rise of these teams that have cultures that are appealing, like the Spurs, like the Warriors, even Cleveland to some extent, because I think LeBron and Kyrie have a very positive impact on the
dynamic. Yeah, plus you get to play JR, which must be cool.
A nonstop entertainment, if nothing else.
That's a book I'd like to write, anyway.
Yeah, but the primacy of being on a team that's functional and not dysfunctional, that's the thing that money can't buy. These guys are so awash in money that having a little bit more money doesn't mean nearly as much as having the thing that money can't buy, which is, you know, going 73-9 or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And Durant is just the next chapter in that longing that these guys seem to have. You know, and maybe Chris Paul winds up playing for the Spurs for the same reason.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's one of the reasons the NBA is separating itself. And I think it's of a piece with the Free Darko mentality.
Hmm. I love that. Well, yeah, it's reshaping that way. By the way, the Sixers could be interesting if they're the next one to have a culture. If the process is a culture, Joel Embiid is a culture. That interests me because it's, okay, we've got these factions established, but it's going to change. It wasn't Golden State and Cleveland a few years ago. San Antonio has been this way for 15 years. Maybe Pop will live forever, although I want him to run for president in 2020. But where will the next one come from? Will it be, you know, the Celtics are trying to put something together. Will it be the Sixers? Will it be something else? Or will it be that these guys, just a bunch of good guys, get together, but they don't have the culture? They have the talent, but they don't quite nail it.
Yeah, and how much does a culture have to include front office, a coach?
Coach, for sure.
Yeah, and I, as you mentioned, the Spurs, and the fact that they've sustained this, you know, the title here.
Robinson's gone. Duncan's gone.
Yeah, but yeah. then there's this other spike in the
yeah.
Spursograph, or whatever you'd call it, where they win that title. And there is some common thread in there besides Pop and R.C. Buford on the floor. And yeah, everybody wants to go there.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, Boston has shown some signs of establishing that culture. And in Philadelphia's
Stevens
case,
is great. Yeah.
Yeah, he is great. Yeah. And Philly is such a great basketball town
mm-hmm.
that I think they would embrace it. The question is, it's also one of the most impatient towns when it comes to fans. So you have that constant tension between, you know, building smart and then what have you done from the way?
I regret to say that I've become somewhat disillusioned with college basketball. It's not necessarily because one and done irks me. First of all, I think the players, A, should be paid if they're going to be forced to go to college. B, shouldn't be forced to go to college at all, frankly. It's freedom of choice. If you're a figure skater or a carpenter or anything else, except a college basketball or football player, you don't have that choice. But fine. But it really does come down to that. That is my objection. It's that it's the labor issue that I'm having a hard time with. And I watch, you know, I'll watch, it used to be that I would watch in November, I'm watching whatever, Bucknell's on, give me anything, ESPN 20, I don't care. And I'm now, I've been reduced to the proverbial person. I'm not even in an office pool, but I pretty much wait until the tournament and that's it. Can you talk me out of this? Can you talk me back into college basketball? Because again, I think the talent is there. One and done, fine. And by the way, there's still plenty of teams that will have upperclassmen who end up going deep into the tournament, including mid-majors, and that's all fine. But it's the social element of it that I just cannot get behind. I'm not saying that the NBA is a bastion of awesomeness in every way, but just kids are fundamentally blocked from their rights, and I can't reconcile that as somebody who tries to be a socially conscious person in the world.
Yeah, I start with a stylistic thing that's going on. It used to be college basketball. I think a lot of its appeal came from zones. It was a different...
Yeah, here's the four corners team. Here's the this team. Yeah.
Yeah, whereas now, from travel team all the way up to the NBA, it's a very integrated, very similar...
College football is the same way, by the way. Pop Warner all the way to college football. They're all playing spread offense. Quarterback throws for 500 yards every time. So
yeah, so if you're looking for something that's differentiated, it's a little harder. But then speaking to your concern about the rights, I think the other thing is, okay, I come at it sort of a little more of the Arne Duncan school.
Okay.
Where I see the problem, and it stems from a similar place. There's this enormous amount of money flowing into this game. All of the coaches are the ADs, or in the case of football, you know, the defensive coordinator at Alabama.
Yeah.
Which is offensive, but the Arne Duncan critique, which I subscribe to, is, look, they're walking away with nothing. I mean, there's no effort to get them a degree.
Yeah,
even.
No. Neither party has any interest, it seems.
Yeah, and if you're not going to get paid, you know, at least give them a shot to walk into the world with something when the odds are that they're not going to be able to play professionally.
Yes.
And that becomes more and more indefensible the more and more money is flowing into the game. So I think it's a little like boxing. Those of us who cover it have to kind of look the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Because
Mayweather's a horrible person. You know, he's the shining light and he's for one of them, and it's just hard. It's just you know, I'm not the privileged white guy sitting here saying, oh, woe is me, my sports have been besmirched, I should deserve better than this. But they have been besmirched. It has nothing to do with me, it has to do with people in the world, and how can you root for boxing? How can you root for this? And you know, the enjoyment of football goes away a little bit when there's headhunting and you know that CTE is going on. It's just for better or for worse, because as a society, we know things. We have to really think hard about what we're rooting for, no matter what sport it is. In some ways, basketball, yes, there's the college thing, but in some ways, the NBA, I can root for LeBron or Chris Paul or Carmelo Anthony because they're unbelievably socially conscious, which we're going to segue to the book in a minute, but that's a good thing. That's going to suck me in even more, aside from the fact that LeBron's awesome. It's, oh, he seems to be a leader for change. Say whatever you want about Michael Jordan. One thing you cannot say is that he put his ass on the line. He didn't. Everybody buys shoes, and that has been taken out of context, I quote. But that's the bottom line. I like this. I like the fact that LeBron is a little bit in my face about it.
Yeah, and it's one of a number of ways I think that pro basketball has distinguished itself pretty positively from the pack of sports.
Yeah.
And the other is just how little artifice there is to it. We know that there's going to be a pool of money and the players are going to get more than half of it.
Yeah.
And isn't that the way it's supposed to be?
Yeah. How about the owners are still going to make a great profit? Everybody makes
Everybody
money.
Wins.
Capitalism at its best. Good.
Exactly. And I was actually, I kind of chuckled at the idea that Patrick Ruby floated this, that
Patrick is hard line.
He is hard line, but I'm really intrigued by the by trying to maybe get some of the historically black colleges to leave the NCAA and create a kind of college, but you get paid.
Wow.
Sort of. And what I love about that is in the NCAA model, the historically black colleges are at the very bottom of the totem pole. And for black colleges to kind of flip the script institutionally to, you know, to start, you know, black athletes matter. I mean, it's almost like you could call the movement something like that. And it's very interesting. I mean, I haven't done all my due diligence on what's being plotted, but there are a lot of really smart agents and lawyers and rabble-rousers who are hitching their wagon to this movement and where it leads. You know, everybody has a little self-interest in it, but where it could lead could be really interesting and maybe really satisfying.
Your underwear drawer is probably terrible, and you know it. You know it. Everybody's is. That's how it goes. But MeUndies, you know what? They're going to fix it. They're going to fix this problem. You can go to MeUndies.com and find the best pair of underwear in the world. It's the most comfortable pair of underwear you will ever own, made from a sustainably sourced, naturally soft fabric that is 3 times softer than cotton. I actually want to know how they calibrated this. I have real questions. But having sampled the product, I have several pairs of MeUndies in my drawer. They're great. They're really comfortable. They look good. They are soft. All that good stuff. And they're much better than the pretty crummy underwear that I had before. There's no question about that. And even better, a 100% satisfaction guarantee if you use MeUndies. They guarantee you will love your undies or your money back. So here's what you do. Right now you go to MeUndies.com/JKP. And you get 20% off your order, plus free shipping and the 100% satisfaction guarantee for the best and softest underwear that you will ever own. Again, 20% off your first pair, free shipping, and the 100% satisfaction guarantee. It's MeUndies.com, MeUndies.com/JKP for Jonah Carey Podcast. It's a limited time offer, so what the heck are you waiting for? MeUndies.com/JKP right now. Fix up that underwear drawer. Make the best decision you can, and you'll be happy. The number one basketball factory in America is DeMatha. Just go down the road to Howard. Markel Fultz goes to Howard.
Yeah, and then
Kevin Durant goes, I mean, all these guys.
And gets a year or two in and then goes to the NBA.
And a great education if he wants it, by the way.
Oh, Howard.
A monster education. Yeah.
Monster education. Yeah. And if you have a collection, say, of NEAC or SWAC schools, they're suddenly getting these guys.
Yeah.
Then the quality of ball there.
Oh, wow.
I mean, they could go cut TV deals.
Georgetown versus Howard and Maryland versus Howard.
Well, Maryland and Georgetown may not want a piece of Howard.
No, they'd hose. Yeah, it'd be like playing Butler when they were coming up for Gonzaga. Wow, that's really interesting.
I mean, it could be fun. I mean, just something to shake it up because the, you know, every time you think there's going to be a labor action or some sort of organization.
Yeah.
Everybody pulls their punch right at the moment that you're going to walk out for the Final Four, and who can blame them? But then people graduate or go pro early, and there's an entirely new labor pool that needs to be radicalized and encouraged to take some action, and then they lose their nerve. And so that cycle repeats itself. So how do you kind of break that? And this is a very provocative.
So Audacity Loop is terrific, by the way, and Pete Souza is almost maybe number one on my hit. Barry Bonds and Pete Souza are two people that I want on the podcast right now. Very different reasons, but the illustrations or the pictures are fantastic, and the ideas are fantastic. And I'm wondering if, you know, we talked about LeBron and the modern generation of basketball players being socially conscious. Was that your way into this thing? Did you say there's something globally happening with basketball that makes this worth talking about on a level above basketball, or was it specifically an Obama idea? It's, oh, this guy's interesting. Oh, he's a basketball guy. Let me see what I can find.
It was the latter. It was much more the Obama being a basketball
guy. Okay.
Got me into it. And I did a story shortly after he was elected in 08, before the inauguration, did a piece for SI about the role the game had played in his life. And I just said to myself, I wonder what'll happen once he's in office. Is he going to continue to have this relationship with the game?
Yeah.
It might be worth just taking notes.
Did he give you access at that point or no?
No. And okay. But what did happen was, okay, he had everybody into the White House after
yeah,
he
yeah.
won anything. But then he would name drop NBA players when he'd go overseas, and he enlisted some people to help get the health bill passed.
Yeah.
And then you'd see this kind of back and forth between the Kobes and the LeBrons and Obama. And a lot of that was very much tied in with issues, you know, not just healthcare,
yeah.
but all sorts of things. And Obama would send a little Valentine's to them, like, you know, Natsun Sali and Kareem and Bill Russell.
Uh-huh.
We've seen, you know, he wasn't slamming Jordan, but he was definitely lifting the current generation
He's
up.
A Bulls guy, too.
He's a Bulls yeah. guy. Yeah, when Derek Rose...
Yeah, with the Eric Garner thing.
With the Eric Garner
yeah.
thing, I Can't Breathe t-shirts at the Barclays Center.
Absolutely.
So there were these things that suddenly I knew that I could carve a chapter out of the book about the game in this era. This
right.
politicization of the locker room. And yeah, there's some contrast that could be drawn, too, between these guys and maybe the Jerry Maguire generation.
Right.
Their money.
Right.
So that was a nice bonus. My interest originally, though, was in him. And also, to be fair, Pete Souza's photos started to come out of the White House,
yeah.
and they were so rich. And that's what led to more of a pictorial treatment of it and not just text.
Right. It's funny reading about his game. And even when you watch just micro clips, you could sort of tell what his game is. Was it Batty who called it janky or something like
yes.
that?
Yes, yeah, very
I
good.
Love that word. Yeah, he's a lefty, which, you know, I grew up and there are always a couple lefties in our crew. And you're almost janky by definition if you're a lefty unless you're Harden or whatever. Although even Harden,
he's kind of janky.
He is with his up fakes or whatever. He does have a little bit of an old man game in him. But I guess in some ways you're kind of making the case about you draw parallels between the way that he plays and the way that he seemed to govern, that he was an unselfish guy in some ways, a willing passer, things of that nature. I find that interesting. And first of all, it reflects terribly on me because I was Kevin McHale. I was a black hole. I talked horrible trash. I would actively try to instigate fights. That's terrible. And I'm you know, a nice fellow in real life, a horrible person on the basketball court. So I was especially interested in this idea of, is this a metaphor, or in your observation, when you see people play a certain way, does that invite real one-to-one comparisons?
Yeah, I mean, so much of that characterization of him came from the unanimity of what people who played with him
right.
and watched him play with said.
Yeah.
Including his brother-in-law, Craig Robinson.
Reggie Love. All
Reggie guys. Love, yeah. And just people who played with him in law school. He was kind of conciliatory. And the thing that really struck with me was that he had that knack, and you know it if you've played, that
yeah.
ability to play with people who are better than you
yes.
are. And that struck me as more than anything analogous to being a chief executive, not just the president, but
yeah.
if you're any kind of executive, surround yourself with really smart people,
yeah.
you subjugate your ego enough that it doesn't bother you that they might be more knowledgeable than you are, you make that work to your advantage.
I'm trying so hard to bite my tongue about the next set of questions that are going to come, but anyway, we're not there yet. We're still at 44. We haven't got to the next number, but yeah.
yeah. And there's been a review or two that's pointed out that maybe the I pushed some analogies a little too far in the book, but the invitation to make the comparisons are there.
Yeah.
You know, that they're, and I've always been a big believer that, you know, the way somebody plays, and not just in basketball, that there's something to read about one's character and the way they play their sport.
Yeah.
You know, Sugar Ray Leonard as a fighter was more surgical than a slugger. And, you know, he's a little more analytical and came from a different kind of background than somebody who might be a brawler. You know?
Sure. Well, and also, his beginnings in the sport are so interesting. He refers to it in his own book a little bit, that his dad was the one who presented him with the ball. His dad, who was never present, gives him a present, and it's a basketball. So it's there's something weighty about the fact that he's going to glom onto this sport. It's almost like a little bit of resentment. And in the 70s, it was totally cool to go up to somebody and say, oh, you're black, you must play basketball. Maybe people do that now too. But there's something about that, and yet that's where he found his peace. That's where he, even going, you know, for much of his time in office too, that was his place to unwind. That was his place to get away from these issues. The element of him being this conflicted, I find fascinating, because the rest of us don't have to go through it. We just say, oh, yeah, you got, we want to play threes, let's go. To hate what you love is so weird to me. I don't even have a question. I just find that very unusual.
Yeah, and he I don't think he hated what he loved, but I think he was always very aware that there was a kind of racial stereotype that follows the game around.
Right.
And, but then his own story is so distinctive. I mean, you know, he's raised by these two elderly grandparents from Kansas in Hawaii, where even though it's incredibly racially diverse, there are not a lot of black people.
Right.
So you come at the issue from any direction, and it's bizarre. And I think what Obama did when he got to Chicago, he just cast his lot with a lot of people who play ball. You know, Michelle's brother, Arnie Duncan. This was his social circle. These were people who were kind of simpatico with him, what he was interested in, what he believed, and it was the way he kind of made his way. And it had its own momentum. Now, as a fan, that's a whole separate thing, but he became that too. He became a Bulls fan. And, and he ended up coaching his daughter, and finds Reggie Love to be his personal aide. And those aren't acts of somebody who is trying to distance himself from the game.
It's true.
You know, and I understand if I did not get to speak to him for the book. I tried.
Yeah.
But I was very grateful that there were, that Pete Susan and the White House cooperated because they did pictures for him.
Follow Pete on Instagram, by the way. My favorite Instagram follow. Phenomenal.
Excellent. Yes. But no, the way Obama was, I lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry. Well, you're talking about Pete, and you're talking about him in the White House giving you permission with some of the photos,
right?
If not with the dialogue.
Yes, and if I had one question to ask him, mm-hmm. if I get the chance to ask, I would ask him about that dilemma. That, you know, here's this game that is so kind of racially fraught.
Yeah.
And does it ever give you pause? Do you ever second guess your passion for it? Do you resent on any level that I'm here asking questions about it when, you know, you've written and spoken on the great issues of our day? I have no real urgency to ask you about those. And what would come back? Because I'm sure he has thought about it. You know, he did a really candid interview with Brian Cumble before the 2008 election. Mm-hmm. He talked about the game and what it's meant to him. And he said something, I love the game because there's an improvisation within a discipline that I find very powerful. Which is it, you know, and it's sort of, and this is I promise you no more of these analogies to governing, but it is that freedom and unity that we strive for as a society. We want individual rights to be protected and individuals to be encouraged to the greatest extent possible to act freely, but we also insist on discipline and cohesion and unity, and clearly he's been thinking about that. And if you read his writings on politics and society, there's a lot of that freedom and unity and kind of what he's really struggling about.
Well, and he's the president who actively engaged in a team sport. You know, unfortunately, we just had the instead of the congressional baseball game, but it's not like you see these guys playing baseball five times a week. It's, you know, some of them are pretty decent, but it's not quite the same thing. This was Obama's thing. And my wife and I, we're on a kick now. We're taking our kids to national parks all over the place. Anywhere. Grand Canyon, Alcatraz, but even like, they were just in Buffalo and they went to the place where McKinley was assassinated. No, I think it's where, McKinley was assassinated and then Roosevelt got sworn in there at this big fair or whatever. And we just had this conversation. We started talking about Jerry Ford recently. Jerry Ford was a badass football player. He was really good. But obviously you cannot play football if you are the president and whatever he was in the 60s at that point. So the fact that you're playing a team sport in office is really interesting. And the current president, forget everything else, is an avid golfer. And golf is, that's the rigor. That's the move. And it just doesn't invite all kinds of differences with golf. First of all, it's not a democratic thing at all. There's some country club implication. There's some racial implication, and not in a good way. You're not cooperating with anybody else. It's fundamentally individual. By the way, I've played golf. It's a fine sport. But it's just so completely 180 different than basketball. And I just wonder, are we going to get anybody else who's going to play team sport in our lifetime? It seems like such a different kind of thing for all kinds of reasons. And when you make these analogies, you can't help it because he's so, you can't say he's so unique. He is unique because he plays a team sport.
Yeah, and he was young enough to still do it. And,
yes,
and true. To be fair, he played a lot of golf too.
He did later on, especially.
And part of the reason he did is he took a nasty elbow to his lip and needed stitches, and that was in his first term. So he's playing a lot up until that happens. And as I understand, the first lady I caught. But yeah, I mean, if he had his druthers,
yeah,
he would have continued to play.
Imagine if he busted his ACL. Imagine what Fox News would have said. Our president is out of commission for a year or whatever because he busted his ACL.
Fox News found plenty to say. Anyway.
I know, but that would have been wow.
Yeah, so really, I think Kennedy, JFK was the analogy, the touch football games and kind of
court. Yeah, yeah.
And touch football is a team sport.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the last time we really had
he was useful as well.
Yeah, with a young family in the White House.
Yeah.
More than just a Chelsea Clinton or Amy Carter,
Right.
Single kid in the White House.
Right.
So, there was a real sense of robustness and vitality when he was sworn into office.
Yeah, he's making the three-pointer on the base. I mean, that impacted people. Like, oh, this, okay. That's, we can't help it. For better or for worse, the current guy, a lot of it was this idea, maybe in some circles, he's an alpha male. He was an older guy, obviously, but there was something about him that was just, he's forceful, he's this, he's that, and image and charisma, whatever kind of charisma, seems to count for a lot in elections, even though we talk about it being issues or whatever. It seems like countries reasonably split between, okay, I like my governance this way, I like my governance this way. Who do you like better still matters a lot, whether it's hitting a jumper or whether it's Taco Bowls, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite little detail from OA is that the two reddest states in the flip to blue were Indiana and North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
And not just because he won them, but he campaigned around basketball in both. So
yeah.
He wins the primary.
Should have gone after Kentucky. And, that might be a little
bridge
too far, yeah.
But then Indiana, of course, he benefited from being a senator of the neighboring
state. Yep.
So the Chicago team penetrates into Indiana pretty deeply. But it still means something there because both of those states flip back for his reelection. But
yes.
I do think basketball took the edge off of the guy who seemed a little alien, whose name was exotic.
Yes.
All that stuff, when he used this idiom to introduce himself to voters in very intimate ways. He scrimmaged with the Carolina varsity in Chapel Hill, and all these photos go out of him hanging in the air, going up against the Tyler Hansbrough. Then he plays 3-on-3 in Kokomo, has his tournament.
Yeah.
Actually, he plays in it, and that's the kind of, they talk about retail campaigning, and in those two states, that's the ultimate retail, is to somehow have the game around it. And, I don't know who the Democrats run who has that kind of cred in the future, if there's anybody with that kind of.
I'm going to find out Bernie's like a champion curler or something like that.
Maybe you can get Wisconsin with that.
It could work. I just wonder, is that something that let me ask it this way. That's a risky move, I guess, to make sports your plank. It can work. It obviously worked in some ways. But if the next person tries to do it, could sports fans come back and say, whoa, I just want my Mike Trout. I want my LeBron. I don't need this. I mean, it's just, even in the last 9 years, I feel like the way that the political tides have gone in this country, and maybe it's a recency effect, but it feels like people are too cynical or blocked to accept that if the next guy or gal comes along, Maya Moore runs for president, I don't know, maybe we wouldn't go for it. Was that something that existed, was specifically 2008, was specifically Obama? Or could somebody else who plays baseball, or golf, or tennis, or whatever, connect with people through sport?
I think the important thing is that it's authentic.
Yeah.
And with Obama, this was completely authentic. Whereas I thought Trump, when he said, no, I'm not going to fill out a bracket before the NCAAs or the ESPN.
That's also authentic. He has no interest in it.
Yep. Yeah, and I, you know, if he had, it would have been strained. It would have been weird. Now, of course, ESPN, I probably felt they had to ask him.
Yeah.
Totally understand that. In fact, they, back in the 2012 campaign, they asked Romney if he wanted to fill out a bracket. And he said, well, that's not really, I don't really know that or follow that.
But that's fair.
That was authentic, yeah, too. They asked. But yeah, I think as long as it comes from a real place, not that it's some sort of a position on an issue, but it's just, it's something about the candidate that they're revealing. And in that process where we're trying to get the measure of these people who want this very powerful position, I think it's valuable, again, as long as it's authentic. And David Axelrod told me something really revealing. He said they were very nervous about introducing him as a basketball player because they didn't want to play into racial stereotypes.
Right.
So look at the early states, Iowa and New Hampshire, very white states. And Axelrod had some experience introducing black politicians to predominantly white electorates.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt it was important that there be a comfort level with the candidate on other things, on the things that were important.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only kind of deep into the New Hampshire campaign that they started arranging these, not really for publicity, early morning pickup games where firefighters or policemen would come in and play with Obama and his staffers. And it was a way to get some exercise and break up the monotony and make these authentic connections. And I think that's that kind of modesty is exactly what's called for in a situation like this. So free advice for anybody who is going to be taking some candidate on the trails.
I want to get to briefly also, it came up a couple of times with you, was writing about the University of Miami and writing about, it's really writing about college athletics and writing about when college athletics go wrong. And my dad bought me an SI subscription in 83, 84, it's like 8, 9 or so. I mean, my whole life. I got a Bill James book and I got an SI subscription almost at exactly the same time. And so I could, there are 10,000 stories to go on, but I think that was something where you made your mark in that way. Has the state of college athletics gotten any better since then? Miami was such a place that was so rife with corruption and it was just very distasteful and so forth. But aside from the fact that we're dealing with do we pay the players or not, have we made any progress? Do you feel like you helped affect any change with what you wrote?
Not really. It's funny, I did the book with Armin Petain,
yep,
back in 89, 90, Raw Recruits. And it was a book that Leonard Shapiro, the Washington Post, had done, I think with Ken Denlinger, called Athletes for Sale, that had come out about 12 or 13 years prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then almost the same interval after Armin and I did our book, there was the Dan Wetzel book, Soul Influence,
yes,
with Don Yeager. And that book, I mean, all three books kind of painted the same picture, but just with some of the details swapped out in terms of, well, the technology to deliver the goods is different,
yeah,
or this shoe brand is more influential than that shoe brand. Uh-huh. So I think in a lot of ways, no, it hasn't changed, certainly not to the better. But I still believe that the biggest disfiguring factor is this flood of money that,
yeah,
just in violation of all the laws of economics, has to go to somebody, and it's going to conference commissioners, for goodness sake. I
mean, yes.
It's just revolting, and has there been any improvement in graduation rates? Well, there's been a little bit of an improvement as a result of the academic progress rate penalties going.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that UConn got punished. So there has been a little bit. And Miles Brand, this guy who had it in with Bob Knight,
yep,
in the NCAA for a while, he deserves some credit for that. But that's really tinkering around the edges. They still haven't figured out how to redirect that money so it's not going into the pockets of people that, I'm sorry, don't deserve it.
No.
There's just no way that, I mean, you can make these sports run, college sports run on autopilot given the amount of money that's floating in there. And the wrong people are getting rich off. So no, I don't think it's gotten better. And I still think it's important that these stories get done.
Yeah.
And I know there's, you know, Deadspin has a cottage industry of
Sure.
So I'm throwing shade at anybody who, you know, piously decries people breaking NCAA rules. But even in reporting on that stuff, we're basically saying that the model's broken.
Yeah.
You know,
they have a point. It is ridiculous that you can't use a calling card. Whatever. No calling cards anymore. You can't get a car wash for free or you're in violation of everything forever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's important that this gets pointed out periodically, just so people are reminded that we have a system that's completely broken, and it will take some very creative lawyer or some courageous judge or some free thinker, and certainly not the NCAA leadership that we witnessed.
There's less an interest in keeping everything going.
They do. And, you know, and even the O'Bannon case,
yep.
Just seemed like such a modest... It wasn't... The decision didn't take us in a bold new direction.
Right. It wasn't Kurt Flood.
It wasn't Kurt
Flood. Yeah. The intentions were genuine, but it just wasn't going to go anywhere.
Yeah, and it pissed off the NCAA, which I suppose there's some value in that.
Right.
I mean, that they were upset and rejected and all that. But it wasn't a game changer. And that's really what we need now.
So, at this point, we talked about you and Michael Farber being in a similar situation where you still hang your shingle at Sports Illustrated, but you're free to roam around and do lots of stuff. You've written a heck of a lot of books, which scare me. I've done 2 solo books. They terrify me. Yet, I'm maybe thinking about another one about a totally different subject. You're busy with the anthology stuff at this moment. That is, a lot of that is curation and research and so forth. Is there something at this point in your career where you say, yeah, I need 3 years. Give me 3 years, I'm going to go jump on this thing.
Well, I could do that. That's a great thing now.
That's great. I'm Freedom 60. Is great.
Yeah, I'm 60 now. I still have some miles on the odometer, I think, to go. And no, I do have that freedom. I've turned down a few chances to do books over the years because my day job was really rewarding and really demanding. So, no.
Kids, don't ever write a book while you're working full time. I've done it. It's such a bad idea.
But make sure that when you do write a book, you really are into it. That
yeah.
it's something that draws you to your station every day.
Yeah.
You're passionate about the story you have to tell. And yeah, and actually, I've got an adventure plotted with the family. We're going to relocate to Berlin in August for the year.
Cool. We're talking in, can I say what state we're in? We're in Vermont. I'll just say we're in the state of Vermont, and it's lovely and idyllic here and all that. So, yeah.
And this is just curious about my family's history. And
cool.
Want to see if there's, my dad was an immigrant and his father was in exile. And curious about whether there might be some story to tell about family saga. And going over there with no preconceived expectations.
You're a reporter.
I'm a reporter.
Yeah.
And just see what there might be there, but no book contract, no nothing, just taking a little bit of a mulligan on life here, and kids will go to an international school, and
awesome.
My wife's a nurse, and she'll get involved with refugee resettlement, and help us
with
something like that.
Awesome.
And so we're very excited, and we're going to kind of refresh the mind, but who knows where that will lead, but that's the kind of thing that
Well, I can tell by your face, you're energized by it. It's really interesting to have different kinds of challenges. This was very different than writing about college athletics or anything. I mean, to be able to have the freedom to know that somebody's going to publish something, here's a way out idea. Oh, yeah, we're into that. Not to say that obviously an Obama book has broad appeal and that makes sense, but it's still to trust you with that assignment to say, you know what, I'm not a political writer per se, but yeah, that sounds good. I like your resume. I like the idea. Let's go with it. You're not a genealogy reporter either, but this is a great idea, and you've built up the credibility to be able to do it. Maybe you will.
Well, I've always been a little bit restless.
That's right.
Probably the craziest thing I ever did was my wife and I started a minor league basketball team.
Yes, we should talk about that a little bit.
And that was
Tell us the name of the basketball team because it kills me.
Vermont Frosty.
Yes.
Frosties are these things that happen in the wintertime to roadbeds here with these huge bumps, crack the pavement. And that was a function of just being restless. And the web had just started, and there was this need for content. And I've been sitting with Marty Blake, the old NBA scouting director,
sure.
He was complaining about the resurgence of the ADA, this new ADA.
Yeah, pre-D-League.
Pre-D-League. We're kind of parallel to the D-League, but so much more Mickey Mouse. And in fact, there was a team in Montreal.
The Dragons.
Well, it was first called the Matrix.
Oh, yes, the Montreal Matrix. It's so 90s.
And then the owner stopped paying the players, and the players revolted, including when we went up to play them, so we almost didn't have a game. And then there was new ownership, and then we renamed the Royal. So, anyway, the new ABA had a red, white, and blue ball. But the thing that Marty Blake was complaining about was that anybody could get a franchise. $5,000 for it.
Wow.
So it was that little detail.
Took the wrong lesson from that discussion.
Well, there were many, many bills to pay beyond the $5,000. So that was part of the saga of it. But it was a wonderful experience in retrospect and an absolutely deadening experience in the midst of it. I mean, just, why are we doing this? But then we would be reminded every now and then why we were doing it when, you know, the family lost their home in a fire before Christmas and we could all go down to this little high school in central Vermont and do a fundraiser to help them move into a new home. And we won two ABA titles in our first two seasons and brought all sorts of excitement to this little state. And it was plenty to write about. And it, on some occasion of the anniversary of the team, maybe I will sit down and do more than just the 15,000 words I threw up on the SI long form site about a year and a half ago. But it's that kind of restlessness that had me. I was supposed to do scorecard for the magazine for a year, and I kind of hit the wall after 9 months. I just sometimes a little ADD kicks in.
Yeah, it's a big slot. I mean, it's like it's a great gig for sure, but you have to want it.
Yeah, and it's so intense. I think.
Yeah.
You know, just ran out of gas. And being able to pick my spots a little bit more here after having done 36 years, told them.
You're inspiring me. I'm feeling good about this. It's good. Writing is, it goes in ebbs and flows, and when I'm in the middle of baseball season, I'm just staring at another 4,000 words, another 4,000 words. But I love it. It's great. It's better than coal mining, but it's just, it's a lot.
Well, and the web changes the metabolism so much.
Yes.
You know, it's just the insatiability of it. And books in particular they just cry out for you having a longer timeline to frame, to digest.
For sure.
And that was the irony of the Frosties experience, because I thought, oh, I've been kicking out these pithy little, you know, 2 or 3 paragraph updates every 2 days. No, and pithy hell, the payroll is due.
And you were responsible.
Yeah, we were responsible for it.
And yeah, I'm pretty sure you're not an MBA or whatever. I guess not.
Yeah. No, all the mistakes we made.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had our little rewards, psychic rewards along the way. But
yeah.
So it was a web content experiment is how it began. Oh. And really, the value in it, if there's any value as a journalist, is to tell the whole story.
Yeah.
Calmly, looking back. You know,
could you do it with as much distance? Could you do it pretty well?
Well, I was able to do it.
The 15,000 words you did, yeah.
Yeah, so. 15,000. Yeah, and it was, that covered most of the bases, but I have another 45,000 words in a Word file somewhere. That maybe when we're at the 10th anniversary now, but maybe at the 15th or the 20th, we'll get a reunion of all the guys from the team. And one of our great players is now an assistant with the Sixers, John Bryant.
Awesome.
And our head coach, a guy from a little town in central Vermont, Will Voigt, coached the Nigerian national team in the Olympics.
Wow.
Korea. He's making his way in the profession. So we feel very good about the little saplings that got planted.
That's fantastic. One last question, which I do at the end of every podcast, and you told me that you've listened to a couple episodes, so I know that you're prepared for this, is a life tip, a nugget of wisdom. I meet you in a bar, I'm Alex, I'm Jonah, and talking about life, this, that, and I say, what's your deal? You tell me your deal.
Well, this may seem a little narrow because it relates to writing, but go with me.
Yeah, please. I'm a good audience anyway.
All right. The thing that I found the hardest about writing, and I have to relearn with almost every assignment, is that the reader does not care what you left in your notebook. That there is no reason to show off to anybody all the all of the things that you discover, depth and breadth of your reporting, and that all that matters is what is presented to the reader, and whether it coheres, that it hits its natural length. And why is it that I have to relearn that lesson over and over again? I don't know, but it's...
Because you're excited. Because
yes,
we are... I describe, especially when I did the book about the Expos, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but when I did the book about the Expos, my favorite stuff was the stuff that happened before I was born. I didn't know anything about the genesis of the team in the 60s. I knew that there was a kooky mayor and whatever. So I'm just like, come with me. I want you to show you this thing because I discovered, like a dog, I just discovered the bone and I'm going to bring it over. And I think that's so hardwired in us as writers. We're desperate to show people and not everybody cares about every detail.
It's the carnival barker in us.
Yes.
It's a vocational thing, the way we're wired, but it's, I think it's also kind of a human thing. And there's a reason that the phrase TMR comes up in life.
Yeah.
And I think that's where this maybe does become at least somewhat of a life tip, that not that the world needs more coy, mysterious people,
right. But
that sometimes just the power of anything you have to say can be enhanced with a little economy, with a gesture or a look or something that's unspoken. People are grateful for that. They can move on to other things that may not have anything to do with you.
Alex Wolf just told me to shut the fuck up. That's great.
No. I'm
the same. I'm a talker. I'm an extrovert. I'm all that stuff. This has been great. What a pleasure. And we were communicating for months. And I said to you, we were communicating by email. And I said, well, I do them all in person. Where do you live? And I'm like, oh, maybe I live in New York. I'll hang out. I live in Vermont. I'm like, I used to live in New Hampshire, that'd be easy. And I'm now, as soon as I leave this house, going over to one of my best buddies. He's getting married this weekend in Vermont. So I drove 9 hours to your house, and this was absolutely delightful. And now I want to go do another podcast with you in Berlin a year from now. So I appreciate this very much.
You can find us. It's great, John. Having listened to your podcast, it's great to know... Now that, in spite of your theme music, you don't have a mullet. I can assure everybody out there in Podland can picture each other with a mullet. So there are all sorts of benefits to our meeting in person finally. But yeah, let's do it again.
I appreciate it. I'm going to tell you one more thing, mostly for the readers' benefit, listeners' benefit. But so I have a wedding tomorrow, and I have another wedding next weekend. And a very good friend, I'm actually like one of the three groomsmen. It's a big deal. And we have walkout music. He says, what's your walkout music when you go down the aisle? Walkout music, as if I'm Mariano Rivera. So I'm thinking about it, and I have a podcast theme. It would be the most obnoxious thing in the world to have your own song playing, and also the funniest thing. So what I decided to do, because that song is based on a terrible song called Oh Sherry by Steve Perry from the 80s, is we're going to have a Sherry playing while I walk down the aisle at my bike.
The inside show.
I'm very, very, very excited about it. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Jonah. My pleasure.